And we are back with episode 710 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and, well, whatever you do, things always turn back to Asia.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and I'm glad to see one of my favorite ships sailing again.
Yes, and when the going gets tough, the tough go to Asia. I don't know. And when there's so much other Star Trek news out there to go through, sometimes some comments manage to slip under the radar, but not as much as people might hope. Anyway, we're going to get into some more episodic discussion. Before we do any of that, Edmund, please give your usual disclaimer.
Absolutely. We will discuss all sorts of details about these episodes we have just seen. So yes, if you haven't seen them, you will be spoiled.
That's right. And we're going to go ahead and jump right into this with 12 Monkeys, Season 2, Episode 10, Fatherland. Cole has his loyalty tested when Ramsey and Rayleigh go rogue, embarking on an unsanctioned mission that sends them to 1961 East Berlin. Once there, they have murder on their minds as they search for an unscrupulous German doctor who knows the location of the witness. And this episode came in at an 8.25. I felt it was a really strong episode, and it's really setting the stage for that three-part finale that they have been ballyhooing so much. And, once again, I wish we could see more of that damn map.
Well, for me, as you might imagine, my half point was slightly higher than yours, but that's because them hanging around 1961 East Berlin was just so much in my love of spy stories wheelhouse, and I thought they actually did a pretty darn good job of evoking the old East and West Berlin and the Wall, and also just some of the little touches of bringing back the FBI agent from the 40s. I thought it was a particularly nice touch. And also that they were injecting a little bit of Doctor Who River Song stuff. Where he mentioned something and then Cole didn't know about it, and it's like, oh, wait a minute, okay, so what other incident that hasn't happened yet is he referring to? Which I thought was a nice touch to bring in, and also just in general, I think that they've been doing a marvelous job of playing these tensions within the group, and not doing it in cliched ways, where you understand the dynamics between these people, and the importance of this mission that they're on, even though it's obviously introducing tensions and misplaced missions and things, just epitomized, in that ending, where Ramsey's does go for the map and not for the kid, we still don't know if whether that's the right move or not. I mean, presumably they have this big finale that we're leading into. I'm feeling very very excited to see how they sort all this out, because I think they've done a pretty darn good job setting it up.
Oh yeah, definitely. Let's see, moving on then to the next on the list, which is Winona Earp, Season 1, Episode 12, House of Memories. An admirer with a gruesome vendetta puts someone familiar in a tight spot. Meanwhile, Winona needs to outsmart Bobo Del Rey and at the same time protect dolls from a new threat. And I gave this one an 8. If nothing else, this season is ending on a strong note. I just really wouldn't be counting on a second season if at this point. But the second half of the season is decent. Not great. Decent.
Okay.
Next on the list, Outcast, Season 1, Episode 3, All Alone Now, A Strange Possession Confronts Kyle and Reverend Anderson. That's putting it mildly. This one also came in at an 8, but a much more positive 8, I must say. This series is definitely doing everything that I was hoping it would do in terms of being creepy. The first use of the term outcast shows up, and it's very mysterious what it means, and I'll just kind of leave it at that. If you are a horror fan, you should be watching the show. Find a way. It's on Cinemax. I know it's not easy, but find a way. Next, we have Powers, Season 2, Episode 4, Stealing Fire. New evidence suggests the main suspect and Retro Girl's murder may be a rare power gone rogue. With contempt between the Powers Division and the FBI escalating to a breaking point, Walker attempts to gain Agent Lang's trust. Oh, is that what they're calling it now? Okay.
Yes.
And I'll just say, all you anime fans out there that have certain fantasies about, Catgirls.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to want to watch season 2, episode 4 of Powers.
Yes.
It's not exactly what you probably thought it would be, but it happens.
It happens, and it features Trisha Helfer, so yes, it's worth it.
That it does. It's certainly interesting. So, beyond that.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
It is an extended sequence. That's why we bring it up. It's not a minor thing. It is actually a plot point.
Yeah, a plot point, and actually plays into past stuff, I think. I'm still not absolutely certain about that, since that seemed to be during a fever dream. But
yes.
I think they are definitely doing a much better job of setting things up in this season. The fact that they could pull off this building collapse and then rescue and recovery operation and make it look pretty darn good for this show, definitely give them the kudos on the technical side. But the way they are sort of folding in now these new powers and the return of some of these older powers Super Shock while he sort of managed to defuse the situation on reputation alone in the previous episode. Now I kind of get the sense as being set up as somebody who could potentially help if he gets his act together. With this new one that's shown up, and this whole idea of introducing gravity waves as a new manifestation, or manifestation we haven't seen anyway, and then they've managed to combine all of the sort of background power stuff with this small P power struggle between Powers Division and the FBI. Are doing it pretty well. I'm enjoying all, a lot of it may be set up at the moment, but I like where they're going with this.
I do agree that maybe the reason this didn't turn up as a higher score is the fact that the timeline of events was a little hard to follow. Mm. What was past and what was present wasn't entirely clear. But even so, the end of the episode drops a huge change and shift in the story.
Absolutely.
And that can't be denied. So next we have Turn, season 3, episode 9, Laid on the Father. Benedict Arnold plots to turn over West Point to the British, and Andre negotiates for Peggy. Ooh. Meanwhile, Abe plots revolt in Setauket.
Yes,
Andre negotiates for Peggy. That just never is something that you want to hear. But anyway, I sum this up by poor Arnold, poor Abe.
Yeah.
This is the penultimate episode for the season, so clearly things are not going well for some characters.
Yeah, the interesting thing about this episode for me was, in a week where we're having person of interest finales with satellite uploads and cruise missiles remotely launched and all the stuff going on Powers and 12 Monkeys. With Turn, we were back to just more basic storytelling. I mean, in terms of the technology involved, and also it felt to me kind of like it was a bit of a throwback TV wise, the plot was hinging on whether certain people could get between certain places and when they arrived there. They still did it rather well. I did particularly like the little nod to the patriotism and chivalry of the time when he did manage to catch up with Arnold and he gave him the shot, but he missed. They did play that out a little bit before they actually confirmed that. Which of course anybody who does know the background knew. It's like no, he's not going to shoot him there. It happens later. But anyway,
Well, you say that, but this show does take liberty with
this can't happen on a lonely riverbank with just three people witnessing it. So.
No, it wouldn't do it that way. And again, penultimate episode of the season. So, at any rate, yes, things are definitely coming together for a very nice finale to this season. And I'm once again hoping it is not the series finale.
Yes, yes.
Fingers crossed. All right. Now we actually finally get to talk about this. I do believe that I actually do not have the correct summary for this one, but that's okay. The last ship.
That's all right.
Yeah, that's fine. The last ship, season 3, episodes 1 and 2, The Scott Effect and Rising Sun. This one coming in at an average of 7.75. And Nadim gave this one some commentary. He gave this one actually a 6.5, which is why it's a little bit lower than what it would have been if it had just been the rest of us. He
says, Nadim.
A disappointing and frustrating return from a show that rarely faltered in its first two seasons. For me, it does seem like a shift in direction, but it actually feels like a natural, organic move for this show. So I'm not sure what the problem was. But no, it does come in at a 7.75. Gary, you seem to like it quite a lot. Gary seemed to like it quite a lot. Okay,
yes,
Edmund.
But apparently the Asians may have interfered with his mic.
they might have. So, Edmund, you also enjoyed this one.
Yeah, I mean, well, I thought, the sort of setup they were doing at the beginning, I mean, to give us the lowdown of what had happened since the presidency was restored, and obviously, you know, the presumption was, you know, that there was various shifts in terms of personnel. You know, we did get the kind of confirmation early on, I believe, that Adam Baldwin is now captain of the Nathan Drake,
Nathan James. Nathan Drake would be Uncharted.
Yes, well, okay. So I've been seeing lots of posts from a couple of people who I might know. Yeah, about.
Moving on.
What I loved was all that administration stuff. My quip about that was, you know, it was like, wow, it's the Midwest Wing, since we're in St. Louis now.
Yes.
But they did actually earn the comparison, because, you know, I think there were some walk and talks in there, and and seeing various people who had been on the ship, you know, now seconded to basically key aid and administration, an advisor duty. That absolutely felt like a natural progression from what we'd seen, and certainly our stalwart captain, you know, as Secretary of Defense, I mean, that certainly made sense. But then, I mean, you know, they sort of went from that to setting up this new situation of trying to get the cure out to the rest of the world, having these problems with distribution in Asia. I thought they did a pretty commendable job of coming up with a relatively realistic way for them to go from, you know, yes, this is supposed, you know, the, you know, we could be doing the Midwest Wing show, but no, we are going to find ways to take all of our main players and get them tossed around Asia, chasing various bad guys, kind of like you were used to.
Gary, your thoughts on this two-part premiere?
Oh, well, again, I was shocked that the Doctor, they actually did kill her off. I mean, I know she was shot at the cliffhanger, but the fact that they actually went ahead and did not bring the actress back was a big surprise for me. I thought they handled it well and recovered from it and gave the character their proper place, but at the same time, I was stunned that she was gone. You know, that being said, I mean, I understood the reactions to her being gone. I thought that was nice. And I enjoy, even though the many of the crew have dispersed, at the same time, they still kept a good mix on the ship. And they still managed to sort of keep the pacing, even with the Midwest Wing issues going on. The action still was still really high throughout this whole episode. Well, throughout both episodes, I enjoyed not only the larger thing, like when the ship's doing something, but when they have these, you know, the small groups of people acting independently, I didn't think they'd quite be able to keep that up, or at least transfer that as the people we become used to have spread out. But they still managed to do it by, you know, grabbing people. Even in Hong Kong, we managed to get two or three people together, which was a little corny perhaps, but at the same time, nice that they did it. It lets the show sort of keep its same flavor even as it tries to expand, which is a nice thing.
I would agree. I like I said, I felt like this was a very natural progression for the series, and I'm quite interested to see where the story goes from here. I do understand why they felt the need to postpone everything by a week. But
oh, yes, absolutely.
I think that, you know, that was the appropriate way to go. But now, yeah, let's see where it goes from here.
Yeah, and oh, and I did just also want to give a shout. I mean, in terms of new cast members coming in, I mean, getting Bridget Regan and Dyken Lockman to join the cast was a nice coup on their part.
Oh, yes. I don't think anyone's going to be complaining about that anytime soon. Those are well-cast parts, let's put it that way. And finally, for this week, we have Wayward Pines, Season 2, Episode 4, Exit Strategy. Xander returns to Wayward Pines with someone unexpected who helps him better understand the Abbey's intentions. At the same time, Rebecca finds herself at odds with Megan over a young girl who's trying to escape a town tradition, and CJ disregards Theo's protest as he leads a brave group on an expedition beyond the fence. Boy, somebody didn't edit their thing very well there. But this one came in at an average of 7.5, and it stayed out of the bottom three as far as I'm concerned, because Gary, actually, you gave this a fairly high score.
Yeah, I've been rather harsh on this on the show for the first few episodes, and it just felt like it was a downward spiral for me. And after we talked about it, I decided to give it an optimistic one more try, and you know, I sat down without distractions and just, you know, watched it on a regular screen, not even trying to catch it on, you know, on a phone or a computer. And I have to say, it felt like it got a little bit better. A lot of the sort of establishing is over and done with now, and I like the whole angle they're actually taking with the Abbeys, as well as the chance to go beyond the walls and that whole argument. And while I really find it sort of disgusting and creepy, the whole procreation talk, at the same time, it does, you know, provide an interesting thought into how humanity would recover from a large catastrophic of, well, I'll say catastrophic, even though it might have taken hundreds of years, from an event like this, and what from your old culture has to be put aside.
Yeah, you know, you bring that up, and quite frankly, that is probably the only storyline this season that has captured my attention, because it reminds me of some of the subplots in something like Battlestar Galactica, of all things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and because it is actually a really good question about how a population-limited survivalist enclave would manage that question. It's really actually intriguing, and I think that it's being explored in some smart ways that I wasn't really expecting this show to deliver. So of all things, that is the one that is probably keeping me from dropping the show myself.
Yeah, I would say, yeah, I mean, I definitely feel the same way about that storyline. And it's because of that that it actually gives me a little bit of hope that some of this stuff they're now also introducing in terms of the Abbeys. And, you know, certainly, I mean, in the premiere episode, I mean, I picked up on the thing of, the Abbeys working together to try and get over the fence. And the fact that they are starting to take a closer, or some of them are trying to take a closer look at that as well. There are intriguing elements that, you know, if they develop them properly, might make this more worth watching than I expected.
Yeah, it might manage to pull itself out of the tailspin. All right, that's it then for the episodic discussion, which means that we can move on to a few open topics. And so the one that I think is probably thematically interesting here to discuss,
yes,
is an article that came out in an interview with Chris Pine as they prepare for the release of the next Star Trek film. And, well, he made the statement, and out of context, boy, does this sound really bad. I don't know that it's much better in context, but we'll try to put it in. Quote unquote, "You can't make cerebral Star Trek in 2016. As you can imagine, there are a lot of people that, well, reacted badly to that. But let me go ahead and read the full quote before we discuss it, okay?
Yes.
"You can't make a cerebral Star Trek in 2016. It just wouldn't work in today's marketplace. You can hide things in there. Star Trek Into Darkness has crazy, really demanding questions and themes, but you have to hide it under the guise of wham, bam, explosions and planets blowing up. It's very, very tricky. The question that our movie poses is, does the Federation mean anything? And in a world where everybody's trying to kill each other all of the time, it's an important thing. Is working together important? Should we all go our separate ways? Does being united against something mean anything?" All right. Like I said, I don't know if in context it's that much better.
No.
I have two kind of things. Well, first of all, I won't even inject my stuff in yet. I want to hear, Edmund, you seem primed and ready to
This is pretty much completely off the cuff, because I was not aware of this interview until we started this recording session. So, you know, yeah, it's this just within the last hour or so. But the first thing that jumps out at me is this presumption that, you know, yes, you know, that the Star Trek world is wham bam explosions, planets blowing up, and where everybody's trying to kill each other all the time. And it's like, well, no, but that's part of the point that, you know, in the original Roddenberry conception was, you know, no, we were seeing our society at a point where we had evolved beyond wanting to kill each other all the time.
I don't know. Is that what he's saying, though? Because I don't think he is. I think what he's saying is that I'm looking beyond where everybody's trying to kill one another all the time. I don't think he means humanity.
Yeah.
Although that is kind of how it turned out in the second film, to a degree.
Well, exactly.
But anyway, I'm just saying I see that maybe a little bit differently the way that he means that. Is, I guess what he's saying is that does this whole idea of the Federation, what does it actually mean if, you know, in the conception of the way things are now? And I don't think he's saying Star Trek has to be big explosions and wham thing. I think it's that he's in a way, I think, saying that this is what the audience has come to expect of everything, of any blockbuster. Which I don't know, that's okay. Just kind of my take on it a little bit. But Gary, what was your take on this?
Oh geez, I already had one rant this week, John. You really want
to... Yes, bring anyway. It on.
Oh yeah, well, honestly, I think he's dead right for a lot of people. People don't want a cerebral movie. Without poking too much anger towards a different mission base, you're always going to get more people to go see the action movie than to see a thinking man's movie. Mm. That's the way it is. A lot of people don't want or don't need to put thought into a movie. They don't need a motivation. They don't need a overarching arc. They don't need true meaning to someone's line. Oh, it was funny. It was a lot of action, and a lot of people don't need that. And that's why Star Trek, and I love it, has never been a huge series, and it never, properly done, it probably won't be. Because as you put forth these important morals, the moral lessons, these important ideas of where humanity should be, they're not always sexy, they're not always action-packed, they're not always great, but they're truths. And the truth still warrants being said and spoken and exemplified. And not everybody's going to want to hear it. Not everybody's – maybe some people don't even need to hear it. But that's why I think a perfect Star Trek movie will never be a half-a-billion-dollar blockbuster, because it will not draw an audience. However, can you still make a great Star Trek movie that maybe does, you know, $300,000, $400,000. Yes, I think you can. But I don't think you can make a Star Trek movie that conveys thoughts and messages. The concept that humanity can do better things than we're doing now, that we don't have to fall into the same pits that we've fallen into for the past, you know, 1,500 or 2,000 years, that we can get better. These are meaningful things to say. There needs to be optimism in the world, and there just is a sheer lack of it right now. And, you know, Star Trek has always been one of those things until recently that had been a point of optimism. I think it's what draws its fan base is that sense of optimism. But it's not going to draw everybody. Some people want the dirt, the scraggly part. They want things to turn out badly, I guess. And as a result of that, you won't have a cerebral movie doing huge, huge business. I would be amazed if that would actually happen, but I don't think it will. And it's sad. I wish more people would be open to that, and because I think the messages that Star Trek could be used as a vehicle for are important and do need to be said and followed and looked up to, but it just seems like people don't want to listen right now.
And I think that actually what he's saying here underneath of it all is that you can't make a film that is 100%, for the reasons that you mentioned, Gary, a thinking man's movie. You have to have what draws in the larger audience, and then he kind of, says it right here. You hide things under the visual flash. And quite frankly, my objection is not to what he's saying per se, but rather this idea that this is new. I don't think it is. I think if you go back to the 10 original films in the original timeline and you look at how they have been received by the public at large, and it's exactly what he's saying here. the motion picture is still considered to be by many a horrible movie. Which one is considered to be the most popular out of all of them? Well, one of the most ballyhooed is the second film, which is about as stripped down as you can get. And it hides a lot of interesting things under what is essentially a submarine movie.
Yes.
The third one, not really well received by people who aren't big fans of Star Trek. Mm-hmm. It has some pretty big ideas, but they also have some set pieces in there. Which one is the most by far popular Star Trek movie ever? The fourth one, it's a comedy. It really doesn't even hold up.
No.
The fifth one, don't even. Oh, jeez.
We do not talk. The fifth one is significant because it did inspire Fall on Your Sword.
Yes. But it may have, but it is also very much. It's flawed, obviously. But the only really saving graces in there are for the Star Trek fans that are looking for character nuggets. That's really it. Star Trek VI. Largely, considered to be one of the more popular ones, but why? It's a lot more action oriented.
I thought six was all is the probably the 80th episode.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah.
It was a perfect. Well, maybe not perfect in the sense of the that anything could have been improved, but it was a perfect example of a Star Trek episode.
And appropriately enough, kind of the send off.
But
at the end of the day, from the larger context of it, there are moments that are in there that are made for mass appeal. Seven, Generations, kind of a mess.
Mm-hmm.
Kind.
Yeah, but also playing to a lot of big action set pieces. Eight, First Contact,
mm-hmm.
essentially a remake of Wrath of Khan. With the Borg. Lots of action set pieces, not a lot of big ideas in there.
Yeah, no, well, the funny thing is, I mean, when you this was first coming up with Gary, I mean, I was thinking about in First Contact, even though it was so incredibly on the nose, I mean, there was Picard explaining to the 21st century refugee from Earth, about how the Federation, doesn't have money anymore and everybody lives together, lives together peacefully. but that was a moment that to me always kind of stuck out like a sore thumb of like, yes, this is our Roddenberry moment in the middle of the movie. But
yeah, but that's what. Doesn't this all play into exactly what Chris Pine is saying now?
Yeah.
I think his mistake isn't in what he's saying. I think it's in saying that it's new. What I found amazing about this was the amount of people who were up in arms saying, how dare he suggest this? Really? Look at the movies that we've seen so far.
Yeah.
The movie franchise has always been about this. The television show, he's not even talking about the television show at this point. He's talking about the movie franchise. Now, what this is going to make very interesting is the direction of Brian Fuller's streaming show that, yes. If we want to bring this all full circle, what are we going to get out of that? Is it going to be the Star Trek that we are maybe looking for, which is the more cerebral side of things? Or is this going to be more in line with action-packed stuff? I think that that's really where the dividing line or the question comes. I think in the movie franchise, there's really no reason for us to question his judgment here, because no, I think the history of the franchise in the movies has been exactly what he says.
Yep. Yep. And by the way, as we were discussing this, I Googled a couple of things. It did come across, somebody has actually done and box office, of course, isn't everything, except it is, the sign of popularity, but, they have done a list of these Star Trek motion pictures to date adjusted for inflation. The Abrams reboot Star Trek is number one. Number two is actually the motion picture.
Really?
Followed by The Voyage Home, followed by Into Darkness. And then Wrath of Khan.
Well, as much as we ballyhoo the unending cloud scenes in the motion picture, people were dying for new Star Trek.
I was there opening day, believe me.
We hadn't seen it in 12 years. We wanted our friends back. We wondered when we were done watching the movie, we still wanted them back because they hadn't quite appeared.
Yes.
But at the same time, we wanted it, bad. So there was a you know, a big send out. I wonder if the original TV series would have fared as well. Before, as Paramount was trying to start a new network, and originally before Star Wars got so big, that was going to be the new network. That was going to be the linchpin for it.
Right. Yep.
And then then Star Wars changed everything, and that didn't happen for a variety of reasons, and they moved it over to the motion picture. So, it was an odd time, and people were hungering for science fiction in general. If you look at the explosion between 77 to say like 82, it was huge, and especially all the Star Trek fans that had been now going to conventions for 12 years, starting to do their own films on it, making their own costumes because nobody sold them, buying the crappiest of molded communicators and phasers that there were. I think I bought one time in like 82. It didn't even flip open. It was just one big chunk.
Right. Oh yeah.
But I was happy. And so I think that might account for those numbers. It was mm-hmm. It was just fun to see them back. But they adjust for inflation, but that's only monetary inflation when they do this. They don't adjust for things like population or mm-hmm. more movie screens or anything like that.
And, I know. Yeah, well,
so it's really not an apple to apples number with that with a 40-year gap. Yeah. Almost.
Yeah, no. I realize that. I mean, if they actually went on tickets sold, I mean, Gone with the Wind would still be the most popular movie of all time, but
Now, you've got I guess what I'm really saying here is that if you had them take the original series and basically said, we're going to take those scripts and we're going to barely touch them, and that's what we're going to use as the basis for our new streaming show, how successful do you think it would be? I think it would struggle rather mightily.
Yeah.
I think even if you took some of the early, even some of the stuff from Next Generation.
Next Generation was infamously bad in the first two seasons, of course.
Well, I'm just saying, even take some of the things that were considered to be some of the high points of Next Generation. Okay. Even today, trying to take that and transplant it to today would not work.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious to see what it is exactly that, because we know that as soon as this stuff hits the first episode is going to hit the network. So as soon as it hits the screen, I can't wait to see what the reaction is. Yeah. I mean, everything that happens right now with the new Star Trek is not unlike the kind of hue and cry that we got from the Next Generation films, even.
Mm-hmm.
Issues with all of them, but mm-hmm. like I said, the film franchise, I'm sorry, it kind of indicts itself on these merits. As good as we think it may be, we're also Trek fans. We're going to find something about it to like.
Mm-hmm.
It's from the larger perspective of drawing in other people. And I've got to say, I've said this many times, I know a lot of people that will never sit down and watch any of those original 10 films that are happy to go and see the new films. I don't think they're substantially that different. I think it's just that it's presented in a way that it is more amenable to the sensibilities of today's audience. It's the same stuff, just repackaged a little bit. Mm-hmm. And what were the biggest problems that we had with Into Darkness? It wasn't the big action pieces. It was the blatant retelling of scenes from Wrath of Khan that didn't need to be word for word.
I'm remembering
that was a huge part of it.
No, that was a huge part. But for me, I also had the major hang up about the final action scene and having yet another generic, let's plow into a city and knock over lots of buildings and not say a word about the consequences.
How about the miracle blood?
We're not going to go completely rehash at this point.
We're not.
But it was that whole thing of where for me it was like, that to me was, I mean, as I was sitting there in the theater as they were setting that up, and I'm like, no, it's Star Trek, tractor beams, come up with something, deflector shield, crash into the bay and take out a few buildings along the shoreline, and instead, no, it was, no, we're just going to slam into San Francisco.
Who do they think they are, Zack Snyder?
Exactly.
Oh, God. All I can say is that I seem to remember at least one Star Trek film involving, ships smashing together.
but that was the one that we didn't even mention before because we don't mention it.
Yes, but you see my I don't know. Look, I get it. There were other issues, but the one that seems to constantly come back is the fact that it's way too – there are some scenes that are way too much of a retread.
Yes.
There are other issues, of course, with the film, but it's not the fact that it – you know, it's that big of a huge departure from what we've seen before.
Yeah, no, I will acknowledge that point. And it's actually one thing that has been intriguing me since, I don't have a blanket embargo on trailers, and plus I did go see movies in the theater, so I have seen the trailer for Star Trek Beyond a few times now, and one thing that has been intriguing me is the whole setup does seem to be something more akin to an old Star Trek episode. The crew thrown into this alien society, having to having to navigate their way through and come up with some sort of solution. So it has been intriguing me in terms of just to see, okay, so how much of that old Federation among an alien race is actually there, and how much of it is just about this big bad leader dude who they have to try and overcome.
It's going to be an interesting balance. I agree. But as I said, it's going to be that reception to the first episode of the new show. That is going to be interesting.
Yeah.
To me, because are they going to go more cerebral because it's on TV, or are they going to
and because it's Brian Fuller. I mean, is the other big
boy, does that
X factor
completely different? Yeah, absolutely. And you just know that you're going to get the complete spectrum of reaction from this.
Mm-hmm.
There are going to be people who absolutely love it and people who absolutely loathe it. On principle. you think I'm kidding, but...
Kidding, I've already lived through it when Next Generation came on. I completely agree with you. I wholeheartedly can remember, sitting in rooms where they booed Wesley, and we were like episode three. I'm like, it was insane. People, like you said, hated it just because it wasn't original, or it wasn't, wasn't this, or... it was irrational, and mm-hmm. Just like we do with any other show, we give it that three or four show bump before we decide to keep watching it or kick it.
You forget back then, it was always full, 22, 24 episode seasons. We would give stuff 10 to 12 episodes at least.
Oh, yeah. And especially if you're hungry for something, it's like, surely it's going to get better, right?
Yeah.
But... Yeah, I mean, I'm just expecting it to be, not unlike Next Generation. You can already get the feeling that people are kind of balking at the, you've seen some complaints, I'm sure, about the fact that they're forcing diversity and all this kind of stuff. Oh, and God. It's Brian Fuller. Can you just give him a little room to maneuver here, guys? They're putting together a good production team. It is going to be intriguing to see whether or not they are forced into a certain direction. But we do know that they're thinking in terms of 13 episode arcs and things like that. So it's, you're going to need to give it a little time. All of that said, I also feel like this may be, depending on where, because we haven't gotten a whole lot of detail yet about what the show is actually going to be about. We've got a lot of speculation, but no actual information. I mean, is this going to be like a reaction to the new film franchise? Or is this going to be more almost like the classic versus new Who type of reaction?
Mm.
Where this is going to be, for some people, the introduction to televised Star Trek. I mean, it's... I don't know. This is going to be very interesting to watch unfold. And there's going to be a lot of people on putting out a lot of judgmental comments about things. And so, I feel like the place for cerebral Star Trek has always been television. But I don't know where this show is going to go.
Yeah. Well, the thing that does kind of piss me off as well is the fact that there is then also going to be the reaction just against the way it's being distributed.
Yes, I agree. what I think is going, that alone could have a massive effect on the future of it.
Yes.
Because people could, based on, and let's bring this all full circle. There could be enough people who are so annoyed at the fact that this is the trigger point for all this stuff with the fandom being basically disrespected,
mm-hmm.
that they completely decide to undercut the streaming side of this. And the fact that it's limited by the streaming, because mm-hmm. you just know they're not going to get the kind of audience that they would get if they put it on a network.
Right.
Even if they put it on the CW.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you know, kind of do the Enterprise thing, right? But no, they're not going to get those kinds of numbers off of their streaming service. And if they do, I'll be astonished. But yeah, the format itself is limiting, and they've now pissed off the fandom when it comes to streaming. Good. Are you killing something that has this much potential?
Well, and I'd like to point out that the, you know, as we look at all these different fan film productions, where are people seeing them? They're streaming them. So you're literally alienating all the people who are already watching.
That is my point.
Right. Oh, well, no, exactly. No, but I think John's right. I mean, just, you know, bringing the week full circle. I mean, you know, the potential knock-on effect between everybody pissed off about what they're doing with the fan films. And then, I mean, even if, you know, that pilot premiere on CBS is brilliant, you know, there may be people saying, it's like, yeah, but, you know, to heck with you, CBS. You know, I ain't going to sign up for this thing now.
Then the problem also becomes, even if it is brilliant, define brilliant. That's where I was getting at.
Well, yes. Like,
yeah. You're basically saying, even if you knock it out of the park,
mm-hmm.
there's still going to be all these barriers to success. But I'm even thinking that Chris Pine is making a great point here. What defines success for Star Trek in 2016? I could see Brian Fuller coming out with something that is multi-layered, has a lot of stuff going on, really exactly what people like us are looking for.
Hannibal
and
in space.
And the general public going,
yeah.
No. Oh, Hannibal in space. There you go. That would get Bron's thumb back.
Yes.
But no, I mean, there's just... We've talked about this from the moment that it was announced that it was going to be on CBS Access, that this was a huge problem. That they are basically going to... They're going to...
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus, under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as Fair Use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the Critical Myth.